as I recall it, Hasan Ali Mansour was one figure in one, the rest of his party, and Hoveyda, and I think Alam Nasir took the lead to organize the other one.
The one party was supposed to be the official regime party, the other was sort of like the loyal opposition. Wasn't that the idea?
That was the idea, yeah. Yes. And I think it was the Rastahi's party that was supposed to be the loyal party, and the Mardom, headed by Alam, was the opposition, and I think that's when Alam was transferred to the job of Minister of Court, from Prime Minister, I think.
Something along those lines. Now, I think in the early fall of 62, or late summer, I'm not sure which, Vice President Lyndon Johnson traveled to Iran. Did you meet him during his visit?
Yes. I did, and we had a brief discussion, and then most of the time was taken up with sort of official functions and so on. I don't think that anything very memorable came out of that visit to Shah
I have read that during the visit Johnson made several statements about the need to balance social justice with military strength. Trying to encourage the Shah to move along social reform lines. Do you remember the Shah's reaction to that?
I do not.
Yeah.
I do not, but he received a lot of those suggestions.
Yeah.
So I think he was pretty inured to them.
Did you get any sense of what the Shah thought about Johnson?
Nothing that I can recall that, no. It was obvious that no great rapport was established. And I think that the Shah would have expressed himself warmly in terms of that rapport, that it was recalling that
When I talked, when I interviewed Robert Comer a year or two ago, he mentioned that he accompanied Johnson on his trip to the Near East in South Asia. Did you meet Comer at this time?
I don't recall when I had my first meeting with Comer. Perhaps he was in Johnson's party, but I don't remember that. However, during his, I already knew him during his subsequent visit, so it's quite possible that my first acquaintanceship developed and did he accompany Johnson. Otherwise, I don't remember his presence. The ambassador, in principle, felt it was a great mistake for people from the White House staff to go traveling around the world and talking with heads of state when that was primarily the responsibility of the ambassador. Mm-hmm. And he felt very strongly that Comer, who was an active and enterprising fellow, would contrive a meeting with the Shah, even if the embassy didn't formally wish to arrange one for him. So the ambassador asked me to just take up all of Comer's time during Comer's visit. But there'd be no effort to see the Shah, and so I was instructed to meet him at the airport, put him on a plane, take him down south to the area where this revolt was underway. We'd keep him down there for, I think it was already known how many days Comer planned to stay. And so fill in his time that way, bring him back and send him up home after having seen an important activity underway, namely the quelling of that small revolt.
Was this the Fars Rebellion, I think? Was one of the tribal groups that was?
This is tribal groups in Fars. Yes, tribal groups of Fars. Two tribes, the Boyar Ahmadi and the Mamasani, are tribes, I think, related in a sense to the Keshgars, but I'm not sure. But I think that Turkey. I think Turkey tried. Unlike the bacteria or straight Persian fire.
Mm-hmm. And this rebellion was being put down with military force? Or?
Being put down, but there was a force, and then the commander of the armed forces was down there with his staff, and a little bit of air action, and some amount of tank activity, and so on.
Were any American military advisors on the scene? Or were they?
I encountered none, and they were not there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But the commander of the armed of ground forces, there. He had, when he received this, he had great maps, which I know he had, like a little Napoleon at the Battle of Austerlitz or something like that. Yeah. This was a battalion, essentially a battalion scale mm-hmm. operation, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
But there were. It was something that was the topic of much conversation at the time. And political implications were sort of exaggerated by some and whatnot. So it was a suitable place to take comment.
Mm-hmm. So people exaggerated the extent of the rebellion, or
the
possibility for
the possibility of its spreading.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know in earlier years the agency had some contacts with some of the tribal groups, as it had with some of the opposition people in the cities. Were there any contacts at this stage?
Yes.
Yeah. But it's just part of the effort to keep tabs with various groups and
exactly track of everybody who might have some special extra grant or special course to promote.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the tribes used to be very important really in early days. Now they've been disarmed, and their tribal organization has been sort of atrophy and fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
But until through World War II, I think the tribes were very, very significant. Many of them have been forced and settled. Into a settled form of life, as peasants looking up the land, and education, and a big change in loyalty to tribal chiefs. Many of them became thoroughly spoiled and corrupted by Western culture, and preferred to spend a good deal of their time in places like Paris and so on, instead of leading the tribe. So the tribes were. Some of them are sort of almost leaderless, rather pathetic bands of people going through their traditional pattern of annual migration through the flocks and all that kind of thing.
The Shah, was the Shah very apprehensive about this rebellion, or did he sort of take it in stride?
I think he felt aware of what trouble tribes, of course, in the past, and so he was a bit apprehensive. You know, his father had quite extensive military operations against the Turkmens and the Bakhtiari and the Kashgars. They all had to be put in their place because they were accustomed to a great deal of tribal autonomy and independence.
Mm-hmm. Now, at the end of 62, the Shah announced the social and economic reform program that became known as the White Revolution. And early in 63, he sponsored a national plebiscite on this program of social reform. What was your assessment of the Shah's, of this effort on the Shah's part?
It was a genuine effort to inspire a certain amount of popular unity behind this thing, which sort of tied in with the other programs that he already had underway, land reform, all those other things. And I think that the great if I'm not mistaken, the great party that was supposed to be the big mover behind that was the, I think, the Rasa Hish party, not my dumb. But I've really forgotten the details. There's a great deal of publicity for it, and people going around traveling with speeches and all of this kind of thing.
Now, one CIA report of this period suggested that the Shah might fail in his reform efforts because he so lacked the support of the urban middle classes. What extent did you see that as a possible obstacle?
I think that was really quite a serious threat, because the disaffected people, many of them the National Front types, I think questioned the sincerity of all of this and thought it was a political move.
And also, I guess according to the State Department report from this period, the Shah's program made traditional elites, the landlords and businessmen, as well as the clerics, frightened, confused, and furious. Did you get any sense of how your contacts and security apparatus might have seen the Shah's program? I imagine some of them had ties to the old elites as well.
Yes, yeah. They did. Well, the old elites just thought that it wouldn't work, and the clergy were outraged, because an essential element of all this program was the removal of the clergy from the administration of the lands owned by the great religious foundations and so on, like the foundations in the Shah and the Gaon and so on, all operations which were conducted by the clergy in a very old-fashioned and inefficient way. Mm-hmm. And the Shah imposed a sort of political management on these great, I don't know what you call them, trusts, foundations, whatever the term for this.
The Vax?
The Vax, yes. Vax. Those are the things that used to support, ancient, used to support Istanbul, all those great mosques, and were all supported by Vax that were located in other parts of the Persian Empire, like Morocco and Algeria and Egypt and so on and so forth. And those Vax collapsed. Istanbul began to get rather run down in appearance. Well, Iran, Turkey of course abolished Vax, but Iran still has these religious Vax. Very, very rich.
Now, in the months after the White Revolution was announced, there was some debate in Washington over whether the Shah was moving fast enough on his reform program. And some officials at the Budget Bureau and the NSC staff, such as Kenneth Hansen, as well as Robert Comer, criticized Ambassador Holmes because he apparently did not press the Shah hard enough on these issues. On the other hand, people like Phillips Talbot, Secretary of State, warned that excessive intervention could backfire and lead to an anti-U.S. reaction. How familiar were you with this debate that was going on in Washington?
I, rather than being a participant, I simply made my little contribution in expressing my views periodically, but I think that it is quite correct that pushing things harder could have created more trouble. And in fact, I think that partly this drive to introduce new ideas of that kind is responsible in part for the events that later developed in Iran, when modernization was forced on them more rapidly than they could digest it.
So you were more or less satisfied with the rate of the Shah's progress?
I think it was impossible to do anything faster.
And Ambassador Holmes was as well?
Yes.
Did Hanson make any visits to
yes.
Iran?
Yes.
To press his views? Or?
Yes. I used to see him. Hanson, he later went to California and became involved with some pharmaceutical company.
I'm not sure.
Making parts things for pregnancies or some birth control devices or something like that.
I'm not sure. Now, during the first months of this same year, 1963, there were major protests in Tehran and other cities against the Shah. And religious critics, such as Ayatollah Khomeini, were beginning to play a major role in the protest movements against the Shah. Now, how much did you know at this stage of things about the influence of critics like Khomeini?
Merely that they were opposition figures, and I think maybe that was the time when Khomeini was in exile. He was exiled first to Turkey and then went to Iraq.
That was in 1964, I think.
Maybe, yes.
Yeah. A year or so later.
Right.
Yeah.
And I personally didn't realize the importance of the influence of the trade at that time. I just thought that Iran had traveled a little bit further along the road to the modern systems. So I'm one of those who kind of failed to appreciate them.
Did any of you, of your officers, have any contact with the clergy?
Yes. Just,
yeah, at this stage? Yeah. So there was some contact?
There was some contact, indeed. Yeah.
Including some that were critics of the Shah?
Yes.
Now, Khomeini was arrested twice in 63, during the first 6 months of the year.
Yes.
And he was arrested the second time in early June. At that stage, major demonstrations broke out in Tehran, Tabriz, and elsewhere. The government moved fairly quickly against the demonstrators, which led to some loss of life in Tehran and a few other cities, but I think particularly in Tehran. Did any of your officers witness the demonstrations in Tehran?
I'm pretty sure, but must have done, but again I say must have done, I don't have a distinct recollection of that. People generally try to witness all demonstrations of that kind.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, I interviewed Gordon Tiger, who was country desk officer in 1963, state. He observed that the Iranian military and police used American supplied equipment when they cleared the streets. Did any U.S. officials play an advisory role in these efforts against the crowds?
I would be very surprised if they did. I'm pretty sure it was not the case. Now, we did have a police mission.
Mm-hmm. To the gendarmerie? To the gendarmerie?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I know that we did supply a lot of riot control equipment, that kind of civilian stuff, equipment for riot control. So they naturally used for whatever we.
The gendarmerie mission was, that was an U.S. Army mission, right?
Yes. And one that sort of antedated everything else, and one that long standing.
Back to General Schwarzkopf in the 40s.
That's right.
Now, according to a number of accounts, the Shah was unwilling to call troops against the demonstrators in Tehran in June 53, and that Asadollah Alam made the decision to use force. Did you hear anything to that effect? Or was this a story designed to pin the blame on Alam? Or?
I think Alam urged it, but Alam would not have taken action without the Shah's approval. So I think it's more a device to pin the blame on Alam. But Alam was elected without the approval. Mm-hmm. His master.
Did the Shah discuss these riots, demonstrations with you?
Yes, we talked about them, and I just don't remember that we really got into anything more than that they have to be put down, and you have to do what it takes to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing more.
Is it true that he believed that Nasser was indirectly responsible for the demonstration?
He had all kinds of suspicions about Nasser, and I think it's quite possible he did believe that. Simply talked about Nasser as a possible factor. But Arabs in general, I mean, he had a thing about Khuzestan as an objective of Arab expansion. The old Arabistan, because although he always used to try to tell me that the inhabitants are really Arabic speaking Persians rather than Persian speaking Arabs in that area.
A fine distinction.
But he felt that Iraq and Nasser as a sort of patron of a greater Arab movement and the area were very much interested in subverting and tearing away Khuzestan from Iraq, which was
Arab. Yeah. I'll ask some more questions about that in a few minutes. But, now, according to some analysts, after June 53, religious opposition and dissident middle class elements in the Bazaar and elsewhere began working more closely together than they had in the past. For example, General Eckhart, who ran the Chief of Army Schmag,
yes,
during this period,
yes,
he noted this relationship in a report that he presented at 55 when he retired from Army Schmag.
Yes.
And Eckhart suggested that the clerics or the opposition group with the greatest capacity to lead an anti-Shah rebellion or uprising. Now you mentioned a minute ago that you were at this stage not appreciative of the role of
right.
religious
yes.
elements.
Right.
Did you change your mind during the '60s, or would you have disagreed with Eckhart's analysis?
No, I think it's correct closeness between the Bazari crowd and the church is one of long standing, and politically I think quite significant.
Now, how closely did the agency follow the activities of Khomeini and other religious leaders during the following years after 53? Was there some attention paid to their
paid, and I think that reports were sent in routinely about what we could find out about that. Oh, indeed.
And did informal contacts continue with religious groupings in the country?
I can only say as far as you know.
Yeah. So you at 53 here in Washington. So.
That's right. Yeah. I'm in Washington with broadened responsibilities and interests.
Uh-huh.
And, although I always retained personal interest in what went on.
Mm-hmm. I guess also during the mid-1960s, covert and informal opposition groupings such as the Fidayeen and the Mujahideen began to develop in Iran, and I guess outside of Iran as well.
Yes.
How much did the agency's Iran specialists know about those particular developments?
I think they knew quite a bit.
Yeah.
Yes. Uh-huh. I guess they were aware of quite a bit of that.
Uh-huh.
Of that activity.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Now, some months before the June uprising in April 1953, Dean Rusk visited Tehran I think part of, as part of the Central meeting, I'm not sure. And at this meeting, the Shah expressed his concern about Egyptian influence in Iraq. And you mentioned a few minutes ago some of the Shah's apprehension about the role of Egypt in the Persian Gulf area.
Right.
To what extent did you share this concern? How realistic did you think it actually was?
I didn't think it was very realistic at all.
Yeah.
At that time. And I think that it never really proved the very realistic in subsequent events, as far as Egyptian participation.
Why do you think the Shah was so fixated on this question? How would you explain it, if you could?
I think he felt that at one time Nasser was making was conducting quite a dynamic program in the Arab world to advance the Arab world and the Sunni world, I suppose, and having that continuous problem with Iraq, with the river and the boundaries and all that, and the Khuzestan was a nice oil, rich oil prize. I think he assumed that Nasser would make that one of his objectives in building a greater Arab alliance, not an Arab state, but a system of states.
Mm-hmm. But you still no real basis for that speculation. But you did not convince him either, I guess. Was the Shah convinced by your
reference to Qatar? No, he hung on to his fears very tenaciously, I'm afraid, and his suspicions. It was not very easy to convince him about that. Mm-hmm.
Do you recall particularly Rusk's visit to Tehran?
Yes, I do. Yeah. But no particular details.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You were briefed him?
Yes.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Did he have much interest in Iran that you could see?
I don't think so. I think it was just sort of his mission at the moment.
And,
but I didn't think there was any particular devotion to that area, to interest in that area. Mm-hmm.
Did your discussions with the Shah include talk about Cento and its prospects?
Yeah.
What was the Shah's assessment of that organization, of Cento?
I think that he felt that Cento did not really enjoy the full American support that he expected, and that he felt that the Cento alliance was more of a sort of a political thing without much military backbone behind it from our side.
Mm-hmm. Did your work include Cento affairs or interests?
Well,
yeah, your work as station chief.
Only insofar as it bore on the Iranian political picture.
So I was one of my interview subjects, Charles Noss, mentioned it when he was in Turkey. Looking as an ambassador, he did some Cento work, and included intelligence exchange between the various embassies.
Yes.
U.S. embassies involved in Cento.
Yes.
They would discuss intelligence issues from time to time. The assistants would meet, including some CIA people, some State Department people would discuss these on a regional basis from time to time.
Yes.
But did that occur while you were?
It did, and we had an officer who, not connected with me at all, whose mission was to deal with Cento matters in the manner you described.
Mm-hmm.
if he was an officer in the political section.
Okay. So that was more a State Department issue, basically.
It was totally a State Department issue.
I see. Okay. Over the years, it's been suggested that Israel had developed intelligence links with Iran, or vice versa, that Iran had developed
intelligence.
But there was a mutual exchange of information and so forth. Did you, were you aware, apprised of these developments when you were
in
Iran?
Yes, I learned about them. I learned about them there. And as I mentioned earlier, I decided to become acquainted with the chap who was, in essence, the Israeli ambassador to Iran. And have an occasional general discussion with him. And of course, was able to follow things from within Sabah.
So you learned a fair amount about the parameters of this cooperation.
Right. Yes. From SADC. Through the technical cooperation that SADC was able to develop with the Israelis, the Israelis installed a very effective telephone tap system in the central telephone exchange in Tehran, which made it possible to monitor foreign telephone conversations and a lot of the internal telephone conversations within Iran. And this system was one of the most up-to-date ones at the time that was possible. And there were several, by several, I mean perhaps two or three Israeli individuals around who provided instruction on how to use this, and who initially sort of supervised the work so the Iranians could then do this themselves.
And then Sabak ended up running it, basically?
Sabak ended up running it. I think one common point of interest between the Israelis and SABAC was the general suspicion of the Arab world on the part of Trump.
Did they share information on what they knew about Arab intentions in the region? And
that's right. It may be that the Israelis fired up his suspicions about Nasser's plans for the area.
They would have had a motive. No. And they would have had a motive, I suppose, just to do that.
Yes.
Did you leave your post in Iran?
I left in October of 63.
How would you describe the political situation in the country around the time of your departure?
It was still generally stable, but with an undercurrent of this trouble with the National Front. There was always that lurking as a possible threat in the background.
But you saw the Shah's position as fairly secure.
Yes, I would have estimated it at that time, and did estimate it to be quite secure.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think earlier in the interview you talked about some of your conversations that you had with executives of the consortium regarding their feelings or their analysis of Iranian stability. This was not have been a problem at this stage. You would have agreed with them that the situation was stable.
Yes.
As opposed to, say, in the late 50s.
That's right.
Yeah. Yes. Around 1950.
Yes.
Okay. Now, I've read that when the Shah heard about the news of President Kennedy's assassination, that he reacted with some he was not displeased. They heard this news that, that Kennedy was out of the picture. Did you hear anything to that effect when you were in Washington?
I just don't remember. Exactly. I just don't remember. But it wouldn't surprise me if he had a slight feeling of relief.
Now, with Johnson becoming president, took place in 53. Let me put it this way: how much continuity was there between the policy approaches taken to Iran by Kennedy and Johnson? Was there any change in emphasis when Johnson during the year or so?
I would say no. I don't think any changes in U.S. policy were noted by me at that time.
Did the interest in internal reform diminish or change in any respect?
No.
The kind of pressure for internal reform?
It continued as before.
Now you returned to Washington after your tour of duty.
Yes. In Iran. Yes.
And you said you had broader responsibilities at that stage.
Right.
But you continue to follow developments?
I continue to follow developments, yes.
Now, it's, during the 60s, CIA would produce on an occasional basis national intelligence estimates on Iran as well as other countries. Did you have input into those?
Yes.
Memos? They were produced by the intelligence division of the agency.
That's right, but
you would read them in advance?
They collected their information from anybody who might have anything. Mm-hmm. So, general review of those.
Mm-hmm. I've read that over the years there was always a certain amount of tension between the CIA's clandestine operations division and the intelligence division, in the sense that the intelligence divisions who worked on country reports were not always sure they were getting all the information that was available on their particular subject. Was this a problem?
No, I would say that there was no problem that time, to my knowledge. I think that the relations are perfectly smooth.
I guess the question that came up was, they were sometimes sometimes the people in the intelligence division were denied information as to the source of a piece of information, and that unless they could,
that's possible.
Yeah, and that they were not sure that if they did not know what the source was, they were not sure how to judge the information's validity.
That's chronic in all situations, in all situations of that type, and two organizations involved. But there was no. That was not a factor of any real importance, I think, in as far as the value of the paper is concerned.
Now, I've read that in 1964, the U.S. and Iran negotiated a new agreement on U.S. monitoring sites. The intelligence facilities.
Yes.
In northern Iran.
Yes.
Did you have any role in those negotiations? Would that have been under your bailiwick? Or
in 64?
Yeah.
I just knew about them.
Oh, then someone else could.
Yeah.
That could have been more a State Department matter in some respects,
right,
in terms of.
It's possible that the ambassador became involved in.
Now, when the negotiations conducted over these listening facilities in Iran, was there a quid pro quo involved in these agreements? What would the Shah have gotten out of them? What would the Shah have gotten out of this, out of his decision to allow the U.S. to continue maintaining these facilities?
I think all I can say about that is that he would have had whatever early warning indications, he would have benefited from whatever early warning indications were provided by this facility.
We might have gotten a part of the take in some respects, in certain circumstances, I think.
In some form.
Uh-huh. Now, according to Alan Goodman, who wrote an article a few years ago on intelligence community in Iran and else and in other countries, he says that it's widely charged that the U.S. government agreed not to spy on the Shah in return for his agreement to permit the intelligence community to operate two listening posts designed to acquire information on Soviet missile tests.
I would say that that's just nonsense, but it's not a thing that I have personal knowledge of.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah. But you don't find it plausible?
No. It's impossible. Okay.
Now, during the period between 63 and 69, when you, I think, when you retired from the government, did the agency continue its contacts with political opposition in Iran, as far as you knew?
As far as I know, yes. But I think, as far as I know, it did.
Did these contacts cause any difficulty for the embassy or the ambassador?
I don't recall.
Were there any tensions over that?
I don't recall the ambassador trying to discourage them. I just don't recommend it.
Now, it's been also been suggested in recent years that at some point or the other, the CIA became more dependent upon Sabah for information on the opposition to the Shah. Was that ever the case when you were the government?
Certainly not to my knowledge. It certainly was not the case up to 1963 and 4. I just very much doubt that it was the case after that.
Mm-hmm. Now, during the first month of 65, at some point, I forget the month, Prime Minister Ali Mansour, who was Alam's successor, Mansour was assassinated, and then there was a fairly near, and then there was an almost successful attempt on the Shah's life shortly thereafter. And apparently these developments made the Shah more security conscious than ever before. Did these developments lead to any expansion in the agency's technical assistance to Sabah, or did Sabah
made their own effort to expand their coverage.
Of course, after Mansour's death, Amir Abbas Hodeida became prime minister. Had you known Hodeida in earlier years?
Yes.
What were your impressions of him?
He came out of the oil company, you know. That's his background, I think. That's right. He was with the oil company for quite a while. After having been in the Foreign Office, and he was just a competent bureaucrat.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think not a very inspiring personality, but was a serious competent bureaucrat.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's a trick.